This just in, hot off the bench press. Planet Fitness has added new strength equipment. Save $28 or more when you join today, and you can be one of the first to try it out. We're raising the bar with new benches, and our new hack squat will have you actually looking forward to leg day. Plus, we're still repping all of the best-in-class equipment we've always had, with most clubs open 24 hours, so you can work out your way on your time. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 10th. See Home Club for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Turned Into Punk Classics, a show where we take old episodes of Turned Into Punk that have been lost from the internet and return them to their previous glory by sticking them back on the feed. You can find this podcast on YouTube, TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, and all other forms of social media. Well, that's pretty much it. At Turned Into Punk, you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamien. I play in a band. More information can be found at fuckedup.cc. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy another TOAP classic. I'm so excited to get to do this, Freddie. This is like a big thrill because, like, I can't think of too many bands more important to the history of music than the Vile Tones, especially for me.
Right. I'm flattered.
And the type of music that I like. I won't go into too many details now because this could be just me speaking about the Vile Tones for an hour, but instead I want to talk to you about you.
Cool, man.
I start off all the podcasts kind of the same way, which is how'd you get into punk? But obviously with you, we're going to go back before that, but right. I guess we'll start them off the same way. So do you remember the first time you got into punk? How'd you get into punk? Start at the beginning. How'd you get into music?
I went from high school into art school. And that's when I had my first band, and it was a garage band.
Bubble, right?
No, it was called the Abridged Version.
Really?
And we had never been in bands before, any of us.
Yeah.
And we were all, like, three of us were from art school, and one guy was my old buddy from the neighborhood that we started playing guitar together, went to a high school, a night class to learn some chords, and that was it. Never, you know? But he played guitar, and I sang, played harmonica. And, you know, we were doing Animals and Stones and, you know, obscure stuff, mm-hmm. right? And then Bubble was a kind of a bar band that they were kind of square. There's a couple of brothers, and Stumpo Brothers. They can, like, close that up.
Yeah, just turn the track.
And are we already going?
Yeah, we're going.
Yeah.
We are going. Sorry about that.
Brothers. And they were called the Gas Company, which I thought was like a stupid name, right? But my guitar player, Rick Farnkoff, he goes by the name of Richard Black, stellar songwriter. But he was in the Abridged Version with me. And that band split up because the guys in the band were getting married and, you know, just sort of had... fell apart.
Did you guys record it all, the Abridged Version, or no?
No. Actually, Rick did. He, you know, on a reel-to-reel, but that stuff got lost. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's none of it's recorded. But it was like, it was pretty exciting stuff, you know? And it was punk, you know?
Yeah.
It was like, I can't describe it any other way because we didn't know what we were doing, mm-hmm. right? And then we got into this band, and they had a backer, and they were, you know, playing record hops that DJs were having. You know, so we were playing to some nice, you know, nice sized crowds. And then eventually we changed the name to Bubble, and we recorded two sides for Dot Records and Regent Studios in New York. It was just the first 24 track studio in New York City that we got to do that. And we were never happy with the release. And the record company obviously wasn't either, because we never got the option of the second single and then the album. And and I was really disillusioned by that. Because the way that they handled it and the way the manager didn't have a clue. You know, he put horns on this record. Horns and, you know. And they were not... And it wasn't even good horns. They were like out of tune or something.
Yeah.
And wavy or... You know, on both sides they did that. So at that point, I just got disillusioned and I started, like, getting better on guitar and accompanying myself, you know, and just, you know, singing my songs. And at that point, I had, like, decided to move to Toronto because I came up here to a Mariposa Folk Festival.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple of chicks, and we drove up in a Volkswagen bus, you know. And we stayed up for the whole festival because I wanted to see J.P. Hutto and the Hawks. They were playing, and also I wanted to see Ramblin' Jack Elliott. They were the two people that caught my interest, and I did. I saw them, but I also met Margarita, who I later married, and her friends, and then I started making friends up here, and I, you know, changed location. You know, I had already beat the draft. They didn't have to worry about that. They classified me 1Y because I was like crazy, you know, or I made them believe that I was crazy.
Yeah.
and I came up here and started investigating the entertainment, because there was a lot of music being made up here, even though it was like, you know, heavy metal and long hair and bell bottoms, and it all sounded the same. There was still places to play,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I had some pretty good gigs where I just go in and play a set and have a crowd come in, and these guys were glad to pay me because I would bring people in, you know.
So when you were playing first in Toronto, what was that scene? Like, you had that band with Peter Aykroyd for a while?
Wheelchair.
Was that, it was like blues rock? Was it like Groundhogs?
No, it was all original music.
Okay.
Yeah, he wrote some stuff, and I wrote some stuff, and we did them together. You know, some stuff he would sing lead on, some I would sing. Mickey caught us at, you know, an open stage at Yuck Yucks, and before punk rock or anything, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I met her there, and she was like, wow, you guys got a lot of energy, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, cool. And then a couple of years later, I ran in her at one of the music stores in Toronto while I was renting some equipment. And she already heard about the Vowel Tones forming and stuff. So I literally discovered the Curse and gave them their first gig at the Crash and Burn with us. And we've been friends ever since, you know.
Was that kind of how it was, though? You were seeing, like, people before punk and everyone kind of came together, but you'd see these people kind of appearing at different places in your life?
Yeah. You know, I got the Iggy and the Stooges show at the Victory Burlesque, right? There was a lot of people there that later were in bands,
mm-hmm.
right? The New York Doll Show at the Victory Burlesque, which was a few months before Iggy, all those people were Cynthia Ross, mm-hmm. Xenia, Cynthia's sister. You know, all the... Steven was there, but Steven was... Let's see, the New York Dolls, he looked like Johnny Thunder, a combination of Johnny Thunders and Davy Johansson, you know, little tiny sweaters, you know, and tight pants and
was that
makeup.
Were those shows before Peter Panic, before you started doing Peter Panic, or
that was after. Time? That was after. I got in some trouble. I was like warehousing pot, and I got busted. Though I had to go away for like 4 months. And I learned how to play electric guitar while I was incarcerated. This place called House of Concord is run by the Salvation Army.
Okay.
They let me have amps, and they let me have an electric guitar, and gave me a room to use.
Yeah.
And I started experimenting with, like, overdriven guitar sounds and stuff. So I wasn't disturbing anybody. And there was a few other guys in there that were, like, into Bachman Turner Overdrive, and they're into Deep Purple and stuff like that. So I kind of, like, maneuvered around them and just, like, learned how to work that guitar, man, you know. So when I got out, that was around 74.
Yeah.
I was really deep into electric at that point. I mean, I'm not a noodler.
You know? Yeah.
I'm a rhythm guitar player. And so I was, like, getting a lot of knowledge about how to do that. I burned a few amps out trying to overdrive one off the other. And, you know.
Experimenting.
Yeah.
Trying to figure it out.
And, I mean, the idea of the Vowel Tones, it wasn't even called the Vowel Tones. It was, you know, it was like Peter was, you know, working with me at that point. But that didn't last because he got hired at Second City and he was, like, really into pursuing acting.
Mm-hmm.
So there was other people I worked with, but they were all zeros, you know. They didn't have an original idea in their head. And So we, I just kept going, you know. And then I was doing a gig, a Peter Panic gig at the Gaswerk.
So did Peter Panic, sorry, I've always been fascinated. I want to talk to you about Peter Panic because I've read about it. Right. Was it just you up there or did you have a band?
No, just me.
It was just you. And were you doing electric?
No, I was using acoustic, but I was using the PA systems of whatever band was at the Gasworks
or
wherever I was playing. So I was able to get the acoustic guitar up real loud.
That's awesome.
With mics.
Yeah, yeah.
And my stuff was very rhythmic, and it wasn't folky.
Yeah.
You know, and I didn't look like a folk singer. You know, I like had this kind of like the way I look now, you know, but, you know, back then. So, and that was kind of weird. People didn't look like that at that point, except my immediate friends, right? My little group of friends. And Steven was in the audience, right? He was there, and he's kind of heckling me, you know, and like egging me on. And he was still in his like David Johansen, Johnny Thunders mode. You know, and I got done my set, and he says, hey man, he was trying to make either a New York accent or a British accent. He was trying to, you know, and I was like, yeah, you know, he's like, could I introduce you, you know? So I said, yeah, sure, man, you know, and so I let him up on the stage and to introduce me, and he's like, I can't remember, he was like, he was doing this the shtick off of the New York Dolls apps, if I say I'm in love, you best believe I'm in love, L-U-V,
yeah,
right? Which goes back to the girl groups, of course. Well, he did that, and then he goes, go, you know? And then he would, like, keep climbing up on the stage and interrupting me, you know, while I'm playing. Well, as a result, I got fired. They didn't like him, right? He was a real rascal.
Yeah.
And they didn't like him. The Greek, I don't know what the Macedonian guys that were serving beer there.
At the Gasworks?
Yeah. They didn't like him. So I got fired. That was my last gig at the Gasworks. And then, you know, I just like kind of, I couldn't get any gigs at that point. It was like things got a little sparse, you know, and the Gasworks was my best one. It was like I got paid well there, you know. And so I started going north with the, you know, PA system and Greyhound bus and just playing bars up north. Marathon, you know, Sudbury, Sault Ste. Marie.
Would you just show up in town and go to the bar and be like, here, or would you call in advance and book it?
I was hooked up with a booking agent.
Oh, you got a booking agent. Yeah.
Booked me, you know. And it wasn't any great shakes, man. It was like... you know, it was a great deal of, carrying stuff around, you know, playing to nobody, you know. But most towns, I always found, like, some friendly people who would, like, invite me over to their place for dinner for, like, moose stew, you know, or moose spaghetti sauce, you know. So I made some friends up there.
Yeah.
I made friends with some bands that were playing up there that later... I ran into while I was in the Wild Tones in Toronto.
Really?
Yeah. And they, you know, they sort of saw me as a folk singer, but I wasn't, you know?
Yeah.
I did some Gordon Lightfoot, I did that, but mostly I was playing original music. And, I did a few Dylan songs. Then I'd run into them. These guys, I forget what their name was. I ran into them at this one place, and then we played the Hotel Isabella with the Wild Tones, and they were playing in another room in the hotel, and, you know, and I had, like, you know, I went to the manager to get paid, and they were, like, standing, it's Freddie, the Wolfgang Brothers, they were called.
Wolfgang Brothers.
Yeah, they were folk.
Yeah.
And they said, what are you into, man, you know? And it's like, I was playing this gig, and it was a rough and tumble gig, man. It was so much fun, but some chick grabbed my... I had a hole in my pants. I had black, skinny black jeans on, and all there was the seam down the middle, like the denim seam, right? So my ass was out. This chick, like, ripped it off, so my ass was really out. And that's when I marched into the manager's office. Like, I walk in there, and my ass out, and the Wolfgang Brothers are going, Freddie, what happened to you?
You got punk.
Yeah, man, I get punked, you know? But they used to do a couple of my songs, my original things that they liked.
That's awesome.
One called Heaven, which eventually got placed on a country album. Do you know who Alan Rohde is?
He feels vaguely familiar, yeah.
He played up here a lot, man, and he wrote the first Oak Ridge Boys hit, oh. I'll Be True to You.
Okay, I know the Oak Ridge
Boys. He was my good buddy, man. He's the same age as me. I met him at Kresge's while I was working as a graphic artist at Kresge's.
Okay.
Kmart headquarters, right? And we both had like similar. He was a songwriter. He came up, he deserted and came up with his wife and two kids, and she was having another kid. So he like got out of the States and came up here, and we hit it off. And he taught me a lot about performance, you know, as a solo artist, mm-hmm. right? He also wrote for Laurie Morgan, Trainwreck of Emotion. He wrote One in a Thousand. I think it's he wrote it for George Jones.
Yeah.
And George Jones recorded. There's tons of stuff that he did. And he put one of my songs that he always does in his act.
Yeah.
On his album. And it's called The Boxcar of Memories. Boxcar Full of Memories. Alan Rohde. He's got a lot of records out.
Have you ever thought about going back and re-recording or recording any of these songs that you wrote?
Well, Heaven, he did such a nice job with it. I didn't, you know.
You're like, that's the definitive version? I'm going to leave it like that?
Yeah. I mean, I did it the other night at the, I pulled that out with John Bora and Sam at the Kamiya's daughter.
Kamiya's daughter, yeah.
Yeah. I did that and I did Waiting for the Man, the Velvet Underground.
Yeah, film. Absolutely.
You know, and that was like, the first things that came into my head.
Did you ever see the Velvet Underground? Did they ever play Philadelphia and stuff? Yeah, I guess they would have definitely played Philadelphia.
Yeah. I saw them once where the Exploding Plastic Inevitable.
Wow.
Which was with Andy Warhol.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a big thing. And it was the it's like the YMCA except for like Jewish YMCA.
Okay, like the JC.
YMHA.
Okay.
Right? And they had the whole second floor, and it was huge, man. And it was light shows, and, you know, it was like acid days, man.
Yeah.
It was really like, And the Velvet Underground were up there playing, but they weren't playing any songs. They were just making noise, you know. About a year after that, I'm walking down the street with my girlfriend, and we're tripping again. And I walk past the coffee house called the Second Fret, little tiny place. I saw Gordon Lightfoot there. I saw a few folk artists there. And it's like in a little thing. It's a Velvet Underground tonight. Velvet Underground, and I was like, Kathy, Velvet Underground. You know, so we said, well, let's go in, right? And we went in, and there was like maybe five other people in there, you know, and they were just finishing their setup, and Lou Reed was a scary looking motherfucker. Let me tell you, man.
Yeah.
You know, he was. You know, I didn't even. He was upstairs like smoking a cigarette in the second floor. I went up to use the washroom. I didn't even want to talk to him because he scared the shit out of me. And he was all in black and real skinny, and he had this big fucking studded belt with big round studs, you know, on it. And he never seen that back then, you know. He's just like thin, you know. And man, I don't even want to talk to that guy, you know. So we went downstairs.
Especially if you're on acid, I can only
imagine. I was like, yeah, some sunshine, man. And so we're just sitting there, and then they come out and they do their last set. And it was Mo Tucker, Sterling Morrison, Lou, and that was it. They had somebody playing keyboards, but I can't remember who. It might have been Doug Yule.
Wow.
I think Doug Yule was playing bass, and Sterling Morrison was going back and forth between rhythm guitar and keyboards. But they did. The whole set was Sister Ray. The whole set.
The whole thing?
A good 40 minutes
of
Sister
Ray.
That's incredible. And, you know, I was, like, swallowing my tongue, and I was like, you know. Me and Kathy was like, we're like, what? Are we really seeing this?
Yeah.
You know, is this? So I was really, really influenced by that show.
Yeah.
You know, I'd learned a lot just by watching him, like, handle himself. And Mo Tucker was, like, one of the ugliest drummers I ever saw in my life, man. She was, like, she was so contorted, you know, while she was playing.
Yeah.
So that cocktail set or a bass drum facing up, you know. And she was, like, started that whole thing with the cramps used to do with Miriam. you know, where it's just like a small drum set, not a whole drum set.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I said, like, these guys are amazing. And at that point, I became like a hardcore Velvet Underground's fan. You know,
yeah.
I got all their albums. I listened to them over and over again. You know, and the biggest thrill was like in the middle of the night, they would play them on the radio, you know, like 3 a.m, you know.
Prime time for Velvet Underground fans, I guess.
Yeah, I was still in Philly at this point.
Yeah, yeah. Did you ever see, they did come up, I guess maybe after, but they did come play Toronto at one point, right? Like 72, 71?
Yeah, actually I saw, it was Lou Reed at that point.
Okay.
Although it was still at Velvet Sound. I saw them with, this band that was really popular that I really never got into. The drummer became the singer after a while. And the singer would wear costumes.
Genesis?
Genesis, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Genesis. They opened... Genesis opened for Lou Reed.
Okay.
And Lou was real basic and real honest, man, and really enjoyable.
Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't sit through Genesis. I went out and snorted some coke and fucking smoked some weed with these Detroit freaks. These guys with really long hair and makeup on, man, and they were like... But they were like tough guys.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and he came over. It's like, can we trade you a little of that blow for a little of this wheat? You know, I was like, sure, man. You know, they're sitting in the lobby, like, with these guys. You know, I could care about Genesis, you know. And there was two cops in the lobby, like, outside, standing down the end, just, like, looking at us, you know, while all this is going down. I think they were scared of these freaks. You know?
They probably didn't want any of that. Like, you guys have fun. Yeah. We're not going to stay that end. We're going to stay at this end of this thing.
Only in Toronto, man.
Only in Toronto.
You know? And then I saw him again. No, I never saw him again after that. It was, he got into that... like the Rock and Roll Animal thing. He was into that for a while, you know. The next time I was at Massey Hall, it was the New York Dolls, Kiss opening for the New York Dolls. All right, New York Dolls were deep into heroin by that time.
Yeah.
First time I saw them, that wasn't the case, and they had a lot of energy. Second time, they're lackluster, you know. There was, you could tell they were starting to lose it because they were, the energy was low. So... they made Kiss look real good.
Yeah.
Because Kiss came out with, like, the big show, man, with the drum riser and the lights. And, you know. Although they weren't as good as the Dolls. I mean,
song-wise.
As far as, like, knowledge of the music that they came from and everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, they were just, like, a metal band, you know. Rock metal band.
Was that kind of like the, I guess that's the division, right? Like, you know, like, people that would... go to these shows and either go for the rock metal stuff or the more esoteric stuff?
Like. Yeah. Yeah, there was like a dividing line, you know. of course, Kiss got really big.
Oh, yeah.
You know. And that was like, you know, that was maybe a year before the punk rock thing started. Though I was like, I was really like looking at the ads in the paper to try to find somebody like-minded.
Yeah.
And I was striking out, you know, and nobody understood what I was talking about. And so I just kept doing it and doing it, persevering. And then one day I saw an ad that said, it was after Ramones played, right, the New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
It said, Ramones, Stooges, stylist, looking for same. And that was Steven.
Yep.
Right?
Where was the ad? What
it was,
shades?
I think it was Globe and Mail.
Oh, it was in the Globe and Mail, the ad, was it?
Yeah, yeah. And no doubt he had friends there and got it for free.
Yeah. Because
he didn't have any money.
That's awesome to see reading the Globe and Mail and see that ad.
So he says, yeah, man, come on over. Bring some tapes. Bring your guitar. You know, it's okay. Trying to sound like he's from New York.
Yeah.
I knew it immediately. That it was like...
Did you know it was the same guy that had been heckling you? Okay, yeah.
So I showed up at his apartment. You know, his little basement apartment. And as soon as I got to the front door, there was like a fucking... a flag, a little flag with a swastika on it. You know? He knocked on the door and he opens the door. And at this point, he had changed his look, man. He had a dyed his hair black and it was very short. And in fact, he was like a mirror image of me, right? He's a little taller. And I went into his apartment and it was like, definitely, there was like a Nazi thing going on, right? So I was like, you know. And then I started looking at him and he started looking familiar, you know. So we went through this stuff and he's like listening to my tapes and some riffs that I had written that I put on cassette. And never played guitar for him. You know, he was just like yay or nay, the stuff that he was listening to. I don't think he had a clue. You know, he was just like trying to be the boss, mm-hmm. trying to be a boss, right? Mm-hmm. And which didn't bother me at all. And then I said to him, right before we left, it like clicked, right? I said, Steve, you know, you don't remember me, do you? He says, what? What do you mean? I said, Steve, you got me fired from Gasworks. He says, me? Nah, I didn't do that. I didn't get you. Steve, you got me. It's not a big deal. I'm not pissed off about it, you know.
But
you got me fired from the Gasworks. So what is? And then I described the moment, and he was saying, "Whoa, I didn't mean to get you fired, man." I thought, "Yeah, I know you didn't mean to." You know, it's like, it's cool, man. It's cool. You know, it's in the past. And so we made arrangements to meet up. He had already met Motor, mm-hmm. and he had this guy named Jack that we called Jackie Death, right, from Hamilton. And Jackie Death was a good bass player. Good musician. He started rehearsing with us, but it was really hard to get him to rehearse because he lived in Hamilton, mm-hmm. and he didn't have a cent to his name. And then we did our first show at the Colonial that Jimmy the Worm and Mike Nightmare booked us for. It was two nights. And the buzz started from there. There's a buzz, you know. It was Chris Haight was at that show.
But the buzz was already there. I wasn't there, obviously, but the legend is that people knew that this band was going to happen, right?
Like, yeah. What was going on is Steven and Motor mm-hmm. did most of the legwork. They had leather jackets and they'd stick vowel tones on the back. You know, we came up with the name.
Yeah.
So that's the name. Cool. I don't think even Steven made that name up. I think he got it from this guy named, called himself Johnny Bristow.
Okay, really?
Yeah, someone from his high school that he knew. Right, pretty bright guy. So, you know, we settled on that, and him and Eva and Motor, they would go out with the girls from the B-Girls, you know, mm-hmm. and they'd all wear, like, the leather jackets, and it was, like, violets, you know, and vial tones on the back. Mm-hmm. You go to the art store, and you get these stick-on leathers, and they're real big, right? So he started, like, you know, kicking tables over and spilling beers and making noise. And in the art school scene, right, there was, like, teenage head guys came up to these shows that were happening. So it was, like, the scene was starting to happen. And it was after the Ramones, right? It was, like, it started to solidify, right?
What about the pre-Ramones band, like Zoom and Simply Sauce? Did you ever see those bands?
Yeah, I saw Zoom at the Bev.
Yeah.
Right? And they did three sets, yeah. You know. And but I could tell that they were on the right track because they were like, you know, they weren't playing the usual bar band fare.
Yeah.
Right. But I really didn't know. I didn't know Chris, you mm-hmm. know. He stood out, you know. He was like the singer and guitar player. John Hamilton was with him. But that band wasn't going anywhere. Yeah. And they recorded some good stuff.
Yeah, I like that single.
It wasn't going anywhere. And so we played this first show at the Colonial, and it went over pretty good. It was like half capacity, right? Then we had to fire Jackie Death because we were pretty irresponsible, but he was even more irresponsible than we were.
Yeah.
You know, we were serious about this band. And he was like, well, you know, I knocked up my girlfriend and my mom's pissed off at me. And it's like, oh, man, 1-2, you're out of the band, you know. So then we didn't have a bass player.
Yeah.
So we put the word out on the street that we were looking for a bass player. And Chris Haight immediately, like, you know, through his brother, Jimmy the Worm, mm-hmm. who was not with us anymore, right, he got steered to us. And he was at that show at the Colonial, and he was impressed with what we did, like with a handful of songs and like no knowledge of anything, you know. So he, you know, he said, you need a bass player? And I said, yeah, man, but like you're a really good guitar player. You want to play bass to my half-assed guitar playing? He said, without a doubt, man. It's like, let's do it, you know? So we started rehearsing. At one point, I quit because Steve was fucking up so bad and kept, like, getting us kicked out of rehearsal spaces and shit like that, and I was like, I had it. And then one day, Motor and him showed up at my door with a case of beer. I had, like, kicked them out. They fell on my stereo and completely smashed my stereo. So I was really like, that's the...
Never forgive shit.
Yeah, really. Yeah. It's like, that's my lifeline, man, you know? So after that, it was like a week later, they showed up at both of them, like puppy dogs, man. It was like, Fred, let us in. I said, fuck off, you guys. All you do is fuck me around. Like, just fuck off, you know? Fred, please, let us in. We got a gig. We got a gig? Oh, you're bullshitting me. You're just fucking, you know. So I, you know, finally they were begging, man. And I was like, okay, all right. And that case of beer looked really good to me. So I...
the right so bribe at the in. Right time.
Yeah, I let him in and we started, you know, we started chatting about this gig. I said, tell me about this gig. Well, Jimmy the Worm set it up, Mike Nightmare, you know, and it's a Colonial again. You know, and we got to get together with Chris and write some more songs. So in a week's time, we wrote another bunch of songs, right? And so we had enough to do a full night. And so we went in there with Chris Haight, who's way, way better showman than Jackie Death. And that's the week, the night, there was three nights that we played. And all three nights, the place was packed, capacity. You know, in fact, the first night I got there, and there was a lineup, like, down the street, you know, around the corner, waiting to get in, you know? It was like a dollar, right? And I was like, whoa, the fuck is going on? Steven was doing his homework, and so was Motor. They were really making the rounds in the scene. So everybody from the scene was there, you know? It was like being at the Ramon show at the New Yorker. All those people were there. And we fucking knocked them dead, man. And we just like, you know, nobody ever seen anything like that. Between Steve and the really like fucking raggedy way that we pulled it off, you know. It was professional, but it was raggedy.
Yeah.
You know. It was, I could see how people were affected by it, you know. And people were cutting themselves up in the audience. And like, you know, Steven was like into breaking bottles and like running.
Yeah.
People were imitating him, you know. Kind of like an art scene, but the sub art scene, you know.
Was it? Did it feel like? Yeah. Was it like performance art? I guess at a certain point with like.
Yeah, it was. I mean, Steven was definitely a performance artist, although he didn't know it.
Yeah.
You know, and then other artists like sort of took him under their wing, and like taught him about that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so he started seeing like the connection, and And we started doing, and we were like in full like Nazi mode at that point, you know, swastikas and, you know, he was like doing the, you know, goose stepping and doing a swastika thing, which didn't bother me, you know, it was far enough away from the Holocaust, you know, and by no way was I a Nazi, you know, it's like, but, you know, for me it was a parody, you know, and, and so we played the three nights, and then we got invited to play CBGB's in New York, you know? So
just after those three shows, those three nights?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Then we came back, we played the Crash and Burn, and got the curse in there, you know? And then it just kept snowballing, man. We kept going back. We played Philly in 77. It was the winter of 77. The place was, like, really tiny, so they would fill it up. We'd do a show, they emptied it out, and they'd bring another crowd in, and we'd do a show, and the next night we'd do the same.
Did you, like, I guess you'd be kind of out of touch with what was happening in Philadelphia, but what were some, like, the Philadelphia scene?
There was no real punk rock scene.
Yeah.
The people that were coming to that were the early fans of punk rock, and then some bands sprung out. That the Sick Kids, Mick Cancer's band, the Sick Kids. Ben Vaughn was in that band.
And Ben Vaughn Combo was another. That's what he did after that.
Yeah,
right?
Later on.
Yeah,
he's still around. He still works with Cancer, and there was the Warm Jets.
Mm-hmm. Helen.
There
Keller?
Was a band called. What were they called? We had a single in a store, Margaret's store. It was called Joey. The Reds.
The Reds, yeah. And they actually did a bunch of singles and then an LP.
Yeah.
Victim.
Yeah. They were the guys that went down to Miami and did all the soundtracks for those, like Miami Vice and those.
That oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah, they synthesizer guys.
Yeah, yeah.
But they had a real fucking nasty... You know,
that first
nasty.
Single's awesome.
Yeah,
Yeah, and the B-side's like Victims, I think.
Yeah.
And I love that first single.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you're right. Like Philadelphia, later on, there's a lot of hardcore bands from Philadelphia, obviously. But like not the first place that I think of a lot of bands necessarily. First wave.
There was just like a spattering. Of punk rock, right? And
was that like? So you guys went down and played CBGBs, then you went back down and played Philadelphia. Did you play any other shows in the U.S.?
And then we went to CBs again.
And CBs again,
this time with Mega Media.
Right? Okay.
With Tibor and then another time we went to Montreal first and then went to CBGBs. So we was like going there. And Max's, actually it was Max's where Steven almost killed me. He dropped me off his back. He convinced me to get on his back and play. I think he seen the Dead Boys do it or something. I don't know. But I was like an idiot and I fucking got on it. And I had fucking back problems for years, man. Neck, right here. Oh, I still get it, you know, when weather gets damp. And I remember it's like Dan Aykroyd was there and he was like, they carried me up to the Dread. They stopped the show. Everybody was there, like Blondie. And the Ramones and John, the Heartbreaker, everybody was there, right? The place was packed. Though I faintly remember getting carried up the stairs into the, I kept blacking out, getting, you know, put in the dressing room. And Danny's like, you all right, Freddie? You all right? Yeah, I was like, yeah, man, I'm fine. It's like, where am I? You know? I was revived.
Yeah.
I felt all right. At Bleaker Bob took me to the hospital to emergency.
It's awesome. That Bleaker Bob.
Bleaker Bob.
That's incredible.
Yeah, man. And on my way out, Steven's standing at the door, and like there's people trying to get in the dressing room, man. There's like we had to keep like, and Steven's standing there. He says, "You all right, Fred? You all right, Fred?" I was like, "Steven, I'm gonna get you for this." Yeah. But I didn't mean to. Steven, I'm going to get you for this. It's like, just like deadpan, right? And then they took me to the hospital.
Wow. So you guys only New York and Philadelphia? You never played anywhere else in the U.S.?
We played, New York, Philadelphia. We were supposed to play in Boston, but the weather was against us.
Yeah.
It was more like Montreal, New York City, Philadelphia. We were supposed to go from Montreal to Boston, but there was like this fucking massive snowstorm, and we just couldn't get there.
Still derails tours to this day.
Yeah.
We've had that same thing kind of happen.
Fucking Boston is really a hard place to play.
Weather's not permitting always there.
Yeah.
So I guess like we jumped ahead because I had to find out about Americans over there, but when you kind of like come back from New York and you do that first show at the Crash and Burn.
Right.
At that point, was it kind of like there's a scene now? Like, I guess Curse was going, Diodes would have been happening already?
Yeah, Diodes was, they were already like, well, they had a record contract.
Yeah.
Right? And so they were in New York a lot, and they were in Boston, and they were on the West Coast, and they went across Canada. You know, they had that record company backing.
Yeah. Right?
And Teenage Head had John Brower and Jack Morrow.
Yeah.
Right, they were their backers, and they were, you know, they were knowledgeable guys, and they were also crooks, so they were like good managers.
Right? Yep, the kind of manager you need.
Yeah, yeah. They kind of pushed Paul Kobach out of it, you know, and started, you know, getting these guys to work a lot, you know. And that was one of our favorite bands. Teenage Head were really good, man.
Was there a kinship right away with Teenage Head?
Oh, yeah.
Between you guys?
Oh, yeah, man. They came to our show at the Colonial, mm-hmm. and they were right up front, and they were, like, digging it, you know? And then the following week, they played a show there, mm-hmm. you know? But they played the Crash and Burn, you know? And they were all, I mean, we, like, were right out of the gate, you know? Like, a few months, and then we're out playing. They had 3 years on us. Mm-hmm. You know, high school kids playing all the time, you know?
Yeah, I think their first show's in 74, and Frankie's still on drums.
Yeah, they grew as a band, you know, from kids. And we were like, you know, we didn't have that experience. We were like putting it together as we went. So as far as like a good rock band, they were way better than us as far as technically, right?
I've always kind of looked at it, and this is just as a fan, but almost like a Sex Pistols Clash kind of dynamic where one is like a confluence of time and space bringing together people, and it's just like a perfect chaos.
Yeah.
And then the other one's like a rock band, like a rock and roll band that's like, that is a professional band, but it's still amazing. Not
because I love punky teenage because love, they were so young.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, so they had that, you know, and the girls loved them, you know, and, you know, we played CBGBs together. Mm-hmm. They headlined, you know, we used their equipment. The Diodes was also the Curse. And the Dents.
Yeah.
Michael Dents Band.
Yeah.
Right?
The only one that never recorded, well, I think they recorded demos, but never put anything out of that.
Right. And, you know, it's like the first night we played, Lydia Lunch grabbed me off the stage and had her way with me that night. You know, took me back to her dungeon, you know, and the Dents were staying in the same room, you know, on across the room in the dark, you know.
Welcome to New York.
Oh man, it was like I can't. What is this really happening? You know.
So how did, please. So how did the relationship with Megamind start? Like how did that whole
Megamedia?
Sorry, Megamind. I'm thinking of the cartoon.
The first time we went to New York was four nights.
Yeah.
Right, and it was like a Canadian showcase. Mm-hmm. Right, the Cramps and Suicide opened for us. Right?
Awesome.
The Cramps had just arrived in New York maybe 6 months before, and they were, and, you know, I saw them, I knew that they were great, you know, and Suicide also, they were both seasoned, you know, but they opened for that Canadian thing for four nights, you know, and, you know, it's like, besides the, you know, the Lydia Lunch connection, man, it was like, you know, Mickey was like banging the Lux Interior on the front steps as I was inside and went same place, right? As the sun was coming up. You know? I mean, like, how punk can you get, man?
That's a crazy, that's the best punk night imaginable.
And also for that trip, Gary Gottop and Gary Cormier, like, gave Steven some money. So the band could eat and stuff and have some beer money while we're down there. And Steve spent it all on clothes. We got down before, him and Eva got down there before us. And we got down there by van, you know. And it was summertime, and we were, like, hungry. And we found them. And so, Steven, you got some money that belongs to us? We'd like to eat, you know. And he was like, Eva's, like, shifting from foot to foot, you know. And it's like, and he's looking at us and... Motor has this way of intimidating people, man. He would, like, have this smile on his face, you know, just a grin.
Yeah.
You know, and he'd stare at you with that grin, you know. At that point, he was already figuring out what Steven was doing. You know, he was, like, he was on to Steven. And so we finally, like, got shook $10 out of him. He had, like, $10 left out. Added, like, $300 that, you know. He bought leather pants. He bought, you know, like, put all this. He went to that fucking that leather place, this Leather Queen place that sold the wristbands.
Yeah, yeah.
He went there and he spent a lot of money there. Luckily, we got paid every night at CBGB, so we got through the trip.
Yeah.
And with money to spare, you know, we had like, we had plenty to eat, you know, we like drank a lot of beer, you know.
When I think I've read Steven talk about going down there and just how it felt like you know, the Vile Tones were on a different, maybe all the Canadian bands were on a different page, that like everyone else in New York was not as punk as everyone had thought they would be.
Yeah.
Did you kind of get the same vibe? Or
They were older.
Okay.
And they were more my age. I was like maybe 5 years older than Steven.
Mm-hmm.
And his people were even like older than me. You know, Patti Smith and Richard Hell.
Yeah.
You could tell they were older. But they're, as far as like being punky, the Dead Boys were definitely starting that punk thing.
Yeah.
You know, Patti Smith was punky, of course, you know, and so was, you know, Richard Hell. And then it was like, you know, the Heartbreakers, you know, all they were all around, you know, Blondie, they were all around. But you got the feeling that they were like really professional,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, heading for something better, where we were just like shabby, man. We were like holding on by our fingernails, you know. And I think that's what he was talking about. I didn't find anything wrong with what they were doing and New York people were doing. I was impressed.
Yeah.
You know. In fact, I learned from it. And you know, every time we went back there, it got better. You know, it's like, you know, people came out to see us. I mean, the first night we were there, it's like before we played, Chris Haight was playing a pinball machine. I'm standing there watching him, and Deborah Harry comes, stands up, and is looking right in his ear, you know, he's like, and, you know, he's like shooting pinball, right? And she says, "Are you the one that cuts himself up?" And Chris said, "No, it's that guy over there," and he points to Steven, right?
So word had already spread. The legend had already begun to spread in New York City, yes, before your arrival.
Yeah. Well, you know, there was like the press in Toronto was pretty, it's widespread. It's like you get written up there, you get written up in England, you get written mm-hmm. up in the States, you know, so people know, mm-hmm. you know, and we got some good art, like press and big newspapers, you know, not even the Sun, you know, it was like Globe and Mail, the Star, you know, front page of the entertainment section.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of, not them, not here, was like the first article was, and it was about the Colonial Show.
Yeah.
Not them, not here. And big black block with like, you know, block letters. You know, I laughed my ass off when I saw it.
Oh, it's like the best headline ever.
Yeah.
If you ever write, when you write your autobiography, that's what you should call it.
Yeah, really. Yeah. Actually, me and Jan House are like thinking of putting a documentary together and maybe a companion book to it, you know, and getting like an alternate story about the Vile Tones, like, other than what Steven tells, right? Because there's a lot of untruth there.
Yeah.
That would, like, set the record straight.
Well, you know, and I think Vile Tones are, you know, one of those bands that, even though they are so appreciated by people that know them, I still think they're underrated,
right,
as far as importance goes.
Yeah.
And any other side to the story will just add to that. So I would love to see that happen.
Yeah, and Jan has a great idea, which I can't really...
Well, when that comes out, everyone's going to be shocked by that, but I'm glad I got an insider scoop.
Yeah, man.
So you come back from New York, there's all this buzz. Is that when you meet the Mega Media? Is that when you get approached by this group?
Yeah, they came like the day after we got back from New York, and Steven already knew Tibor mm-hmm. and Steve Zoller, and they were hired by Don Jean Louis, Don Jean Louis, who is an artist. He made art out of neon lights, right?
Was he part of General Idea? Was that?
I don't think he was involved with them. He was like working for a big broadcasting company.
Okay.
And that's what he did. He was like this artist that, and he was rich, right? Or he knew how to get money.
Yeah.
We never really had much to do with him. The one big thing that he did that I disagreed with is he took Danger Boy, that we recorded in 24 track, and went into the studio with another lead guitar player and redid it, you know, and it didn't sound like the Vile Tones after that. There's an example of it on A Taste of Honey. There's a an extra cut that's not listed, which is Danger Boy, but without that overdub.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Right? It's just me playing my poor excuse for leads. I never played leads, you know. It was like I used other things.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And but if you listen to the CD, you know, you let it go to the very end, and you'll hear the other version of Danger Boy. The one that they put up top is an alternate version.
Yeah. Right?
And Don Jean Louis was like instrumental in that, like putting that thing, thinking that I'm going to turn these guys into a pop band.
Yeah.
You know, wasn't going to happen. You know, it just wasn't going to happen. We were just like too fucking crazy. So all of us. And
was the plan for Mega Media to eventually sign you to a major, or did they want to eventually just be your label?
Yeah, they tried like hell to sign us to a major. That's what, you know, and they had, when we played CB's the second time, Tibor even said to Steven, he says, like, cool it on the Nazi stuff, because we got, like, the guy from Star Record, Marty Thal,
mm-hmm.
and Seymour Stein, you know, they're coming down to see you guys, you know. So cool it on the Nazis. Of course, Steven had the hat on and fucking, you know, fucking swastikas and, iron, you know, like Iron Cross, you know, it's like,
yeah.
He didn't wish to cool it.
Not at all.
So, so it was like, I think they gave up on the whole idea of like a major label after that.
Had like the Jewish, because there was a time, I remember reading an article, the Jewish Defense League was coming to the Vile Tones shows, or there's like a protest letter or something.
That was bullshit.
That was all bullshit?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that was Stevens. Yeah.
That's never happened. Okay.
That's his way of getting out of that.
Yeah. Right? And, yeah.
But no, that never happened. There was another guy, the guy that managed the Ramones. He also managed the Stooges. He was...
Danny Fields.
That's right.
The guy who signed, yeah.
And he wrote, in High Times magazine, he wrote a whole, like, editorial on the front, the second page, about the Nazi thing and how it really wasn't offensive to use that, you know, because the Ramones had some Nazi theme songs.
Yeah, yeah. Right?
And he used us as an example, you know, and he liked us. Danny Fields really liked us, you know, and he wasn't offended by anything we did. And because it really, you know, I mean, if the kids loved it, and the kids were like, a lot of Jewish kids loved us, you know, they were like, they got the joke. They got the joke because that's what it was. It was a joke, you know. And I mean, like when you piss on a Nazi flag, I think you get the message across, you know. Steven have these Nazi flags and put them on and piss on them, you know.
It's not really an endorsement, I guess, when you're pissing on the flag.
You know, so it's obviously, like, we're like, you know, if we were in Nazi Germany, the Vile Tones were in Nazi Germany, we'd have been killed, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we're just too nasty. We're too anti-everything, you know.
So when you guys recorded Screaming Fist... Had you demo before that, right?
No.
No, that was the first recording ever?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. There's you know, some stuff. There was stuff that was recorded live, but it was also filmed.
Yeah, I've seen that Colonial footage, the black and white footage. Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, what's his name? Henry Martinique redid it and colorized it.
Yeah.
It was in color, actually, but it was too dark, so it came out looking black and white.
Okay.
Though somehow he enhanced it and got the color up. It looks great.
That's awesome.
You know?
So was that actually, before we get into the single, because I could talk about the single for an hour, and we've already talked for almost an hour, yeah. So I won't keep you too much longer.
Okay.
But the CBC broadcast with you and the Poles and Teenage Head, did that happen before you recorded, or is that after?
That was before.
Yeah.
That was right because of Crash and Burn, and those guys were like really good at promotion, the Diodes, right? They were art schoolers, and they were studying that shit.
Yeah.
So, you know, they set that up, and it was Teenage Head, us, and the Poles, and pretty cool interview, you know, where Steven says, oh, I'm trying to create a generation gap.
Yeah, you know? He pulls up the screwdriver at one point. Yeah, right. Carrying around the screwdriver.
Yeah,
that might be my favorite moment in Canadian television history. That episode.
This is going to hurt a hell of a lot more
than a knife.
Yeah.
I love it. So, I'm sorry, I just had to talk about that. Was that, actually, that experience, what was that like? Like, was it a media circus at that point?
It was starting to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, it got worse as we went on. But, you know, they started off with a couple of derogatory reviews.
Yeah.
You know, really slamming us. And, of course, that girl that was interviewing us
hated it.
Yeah. She's like, I got a headache.
Yeah.
That, you know, Frankie Venom was like, oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I've been listening to your music all afternoon. And all I got out of it was a headache. Because nothing she said to him. Well, her suffering was for my enjoyment because I love that video. I've watched that thousands of times.
Oh, yeah, man. Well, she eventually turned.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, she started coming
to
the show.
It took her about 10 years, but she eventually turned.
They all come around in the end.
Yeah.
They all realize.
Really.
So when, I guess, like, was there a media circus before the single came out? Like, what was the climate when you guys were recording?
No, the media circus was already in play,
mm-hmm.
and it was like getting bigger, right? And that's when we got back from New York. We met Tibor and Steve at Chris Haight's girlfriend's place out in towards Scarborough somewhere, you know, and they came and they had a presentation for us, and they said that they wanted to manage us, and what they would do, they would furnish us with good equipment,
mm-hmm.
and a good rehearsal space, and promotion, and they would speak for us, and they would put a record out for us, which was that record, Skin
mm-hmm.
and Fist.
Mm-hmm.
Tibor mixed that record. Tibor.
Wow.
You know?
Do you mix any other records? Did you do anything else?
Well, yeah. Well, we did like everything
yeah.
that we had at that. But we did five songs. We did Scream Fist, Rebel Unorthodox, Possibilities, Danger Boy, and another song. I forget which one it was. It might be Does She Jump? The rest was all two-track, you know? Because we had like done all of those in record time. And the engineer said, well, we got like so much time left. You know, do you want to record everything else you have? So he said, yeah, why not? So he set up the two-track, and we recorded it on two-track.
Yeah.
And it sounds just as good as a 24-track mix, right? But then, you know, Tibor mixed it after that. He mixed the fucking thing. And he did a great job, man. He's got a good ear.
Yeah.
You know? He knew Steven already from Metal Messiah. He wanted Steven to be in that movie, and then Steven was, like, too unmanageable, so...
Couldn't do it.
No, he couldn't. But he knew Steven, and he was friends with Steven, and that's how they got in touch with us, through Steven. And,
Hey!
Sorry. Oh, you're back.
We can pause for a sec.
We're trying to be quiet.
Yeah, that's what we went to. I think it was an Ajax or somewhere. A farmhouse, man. And this guy, when I walked in, I was like, this guy is not going to like us, right? Because he was a hippie.
Yeah.
He had real long hair and a beard. But he loved us, man. He was like, loved how fast we worked and how fast we got the work done, you know? And then he started listening to music. He says, man, you fucking guys are good, you know? I was like, thanks, man. I didn't expect that.
Yeah.
You know? And so that's, you know... Said he asked, he offered to, you know, record everything, and
yeah.
we did record everything, and everything was also like digitalized and put on A Taste of Honey.
Yeah,
right.
So that's that complete session that day.
Yeah, it was like, yeah, it all came from that session, and what's this like? Chris Betting was the guy that digitalized it,
mm-hmm.
and mixed it, and Peter J. Moore, you know, he works with Jan House quite
mm-hmm.
a bit,
mm-hmm.
right, and. So, you know, none of that stuff came out on record except the three songs.
Yeah.
And then Jan, you know, did that Black Hole of Fame or Black Hole of Punk or whatever. He put out almost all of the punk bands from
yeah,
Toronto
yeah, yeah.
of that era.
A series.
Put them all on, you know.
That was the single when it came out. It's amazing where it turns up because, like, you know, the Bad Brains, the guys that would go on forming the Bad yeah. Brains, buy it in D.C., and that's a big record for them.
Right.
It's also, you hear about people, it got reviewed in British fanzines, too,
yeah.
English fanzines at the time.
Yeah.
And I think it even got reviewed in, like, Slash, maybe even, or one of the L.A. fanzines, I think.
Yeah, we got, the Vile Tones, yeah, got reviews in Slash, and and a Melody Maker.
Yeah, yeah.
And what's that other paper from England?
NME?
Hmm? Yeah.
Or Sounds, yeah. Maybe. Or, yeah, like, yeah. It was definitely... it's so interesting to think that, like, an independent record put out by a label that's never put out anything else,
yeah,
had that kind of distribution, that kind of reach.
Yeah. We got written up in Andy Warhol's interview, and they named us, like, my favorite free record this month is...
Wow.
You know, and they gave us a good review. Variety gave us a great review on the show. Who else, man? We got, like... what's his name? The guy from the Barracudas.
Oh, Rough Trade? Trouser Press? Did you try?
Jeremy Gluck.
Okay.
He was in Barracudas. He wrote up, before he was in Barracudas, he wrote for Sounds and gave us a great write-up. You know, it was like he was John the Baptist and he was preparing England for the Vile Tones, right?
So was there ever... any talk of touring England or touring America on that? Like, obviously, it was harder for bands to tour at that point.
We were planning on going, right? At that point, Mega Media was out of the picture. And Roger Main and a guy named, I can't remember his name, he owned, like, an Army Surplus store up on College Street. His dad owned it. He was backing it. Roger Main was going to record us, and so that's the look back in anger.
Yeah.
At that point, we split up because Steven was doing some really shit that was, like, you know, counterproductive, and we wanted to go to Europe. We were, like, making money, and we're banking it, and Steven didn't want to bank it. He wanted it all,
mm-hmm.
Right? He said, no, man, we're going to England. Right, and he kept, like, bucking that. He would say, "You got to get your passport. We're going to go to England." You know, he would never get his passport. And then one day he shows up with Sam Pereira.
Mm-hmm.
Right, he literally hijacked him from the Ugly.
Yeah,
right. And he says, "Sam's going to play bass for us." And then we rehearsed him a few times, and we went and we did. Look Back in Anger with Sam playing bass, but he kind of killed our sound. As excellent as he is, a musician and a person, he smoothed it out too much.
Mm-hmm.
Where we had that, like, staccato kind of rhythm section with Motor and Chris, right? It was like a hard edge kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't like a classic rock band, and that's what, you know, the second EP sort of started sounding like a classic rock band, and to our dissatisfaction, you know. And then, you know, the show at the Hotel Isabella, where Sam played with us at that show. We got through two songs, and he started a fight with the bartender, and he jumped over the... You know, and so it stopped. The show stopped. We still got paid. We got paid a lot of money. And he came up to the dressing room with Eva and demanded, like, a large sum of that money, you know. I said, "Steven, you didn't do anything. You didn't even play the show, you know. It's like we didn't get to play the show. Like, we're banking this money and we're going to England, right?" So that was like, "I quit." You know, "I quit." And it's like for the 20th time, right? So me and Motor and Chris were like, "All right, so I guess enter the secrets," you know? And that's where we went after that.
Was there already a plan to do the secret? Had you guys already been talking about doing like another band just for
fun?
Well,
we had, it was called like the Secrets Review, and we were bringing other people, like,
yeah,
you know, on stage, right? I was like actually a guest singer in that. It was Zoom. Right.
Okay.
And so I started like singing, and then my part got bigger and bigger, and you know, but it was still just, you know, Secrets Review.
Yeah.
And then the next day after that conflict, you know, Steven calls me up. He says, "Hey, man, listen, we'll get rid of Chris Haight, and we'll get rid of Motor, and get Tony to play drums, and, you know, I want you to stay with us." And I said, "Now, Steve, I can't work with you anymore, man. I'm sorry. You know, there's no way I was going to turn my way up, you know, turn on motor or crit. Just wasn't going to happen. That's like, that's not street, man. That's like, you know.
You just don't do it.
Yeah. You got brothers, man. You got to, you know, you got to go with your brothers, man. And so that's what, you know. And we, you know, we made some good music with, you know, we got a record contract. We got, you know, things that we couldn't get with the Voltones. And Steven went on to, you know, be with those guys. So it was Voltones too.
I can understand why the major labels would have been frightened of the Voltones, given, like, you know, the aesthetic and just the fact that it's a lot more abrasive than stuff. Right. But what about, like, even, like, Bomb, who you Bomb, who you eventually do stuff with, and, like, there were other Toronto, were any of those labels sniffing around the Voltones, or was it just too extreme for everyone?
You know, like, years later, Steven did that live album.
Yeah.
Sunday, yesterday morning.
Saturday night, Sunday morning.
Yeah. At the Larry's Hideaway, I think it was. And that was a record company. I don't know who they were. But it was, like, recorded live. It was direct-to-disc, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, kind of groundbreaking. So it was, like, they were trying to get people to record with them.
Yeah.
With that process, right? So they, you know, got the Voltones. You know, we were long gone, you know, and we, like, made out a lot better as far as, like, getting our music out there. And, you know, I mean, I found those records, Success Without College, in New Jersey and Delaware County and, you know, New York. I would find them, like, you know, so they got distributed widely.
Really well, yeah.
And then when, you know, Taste of Honey came out, and then The Secret's Teenage Rampage, those got a lot of attention, you know, and they were, you could see, still today, you go on eBay, and you're like, you could get them used, you can get them new, and the bar that I hang out with in Philly at this place called The Pope, they have a great jukebox, and they got the Voltones on there.
Really? They got them both?
Yeah, and it's like the most played record
on
the jukebox.
Yeah. I bet.
Yeah.
It's amazing when, you know, like, how, well, there's that Sonic Youth when they came to town in 1991, where he's, like, yelling about, Thurston Moore's on stage yelling about the Voltones and wanting to meet the Voltones and stuff like that. Like, it's just, it's like a band that's become, well, as I've been saying a lot, become so much larger than just a band in a lot of ways.
I could add to that, man. Thurston Moore was doing an interview with a friend of mine in England who has a radio, like a podcast thing. And he saw, I gave him a single, a Voltone single, one of the original ones. Mm-hmm. And he had it all up on the wall, and Thurston Moore was like, "Whoa, man, Voltone single. Yeah, you into the Voltone?" He says, "Well, Freddie's a friend of mine, you know." "No shit, man." And it's like, started, like, talking about, "I got all their records, you know."
Well, actually, speaking of records then, how did that Montrecos 12-inch come about?
Montreco. That came out the same time as the first one, the first EP. In fact, it is the EP, but it's on
a 12-inch, yeah.
It was actually sold to them as an album.
Oh, really? They thought they were getting a full length?
Yeah, Tibor. So these Montreal gangsters wanted, you know, and they had, like, all the things were, like, if it was punk, it had a safety pin in the corner.
Yeah.
You know, if it was pop, it had, you know, it's like, and they had, like, a few punk bands.
It was mainly licenses, except for The Action. I think The Action 12-inch is the only band from Ottawa.
Yeah.
But everything else is, like, Venus and the Razor Blades, and then Pretty Boy Floyd and the Gems.
Yeah.
I think there's just the four, right?
Yeah.
If I remember correctly. And then the Comp, Permanent Wave.
Yeah. That stuff was, like, Montreco was, like, a chain. It was, like a drugstore or like a variety store.
Yeah.
You know, with a pharmacy in the place and everything. And they, you know, like Kmart.
Like a Woolworths, you know, Kmart. Hotel. Yeah.
It was like that.
That's their store brand for...
Yeah, they had a rack with all those records, and they were all black.
Yep.
You know, and each of them had their little, you know, icon on it.
Yep.
You know? And
did they ever do... Because, like... I don't know if Mickey's warned you about this, but I'm a horrible record nerd, like someone that makes Greg Dick look slightly more sane. every 12-inch that they did a promo version with a cover pasted to the front of it.
Yeah.
I've never seen a Vile Tones one. Was there one?
I did. I saw
one. Oh, crazy.
The drummer in my band, Fight Fucker Dance.
Yeah.
But the old drummer, he's a distributor.
Yeah.
And he found that.
Wow. Yeah.
And I was amazed.
Yeah, I've never seen one. I've seen all the other ones with something pasted on, but never that one.
It's the first single, that cover on the first single.
Wow, just pasted on
it. Blew up to 12 inches, and pasted it on there.
That's a number one on my want list now, Freddie. I got to put that on my want list now. And also, since we're going down my nerdy path right now, how come so many of the first Vile Tones 7 inches have a sample stamp? Were those ones given away as promo?
Sony?
Sample. They all have the word sample stamped on them.
That was a test pressing.
Oh, really? That's all the test
pressing? And it was on flimsy paper.
Yeah, they're all flimsy paper.
You know, and the stamp was actually on the plastic.
Okay.
And it was red.
Yeah, there's red one, yeah.
Though usually what you see, you see bootlegs with the stamp in black.
Yeah, there's a black stamp. But then I've also seen an original with a black stamp. And then I saw one with a blank sleeve and just the sample stamp on it. Sorry, we could go down this nerdy path.
Mickey just showed me this afternoon a fucking thing called, what's that called, Mickey? The one with the live at Hotel Isabella.
You want me to go get it?
Yeah. I think Damien would love to see this.
Well, you know what? I just want to nerd out with both of you right now, and I would love to have you back for a part two, Freddie, at some point.
Okay.
And when I go to Philadelphia, or because we didn't talk enough about the secrets. I want to talk more about Vile Tones. There's so many more stories, but I've kept you for over an hour now, and I really appreciate you giving me this time, because honestly, hopefully this has come across, but without the music that you and Mickey too, because Mickey, you're in the room, but without what you guys did, I wouldn't be able doing what I'm doing now. So I really owe you guys a huge debt. Thank you for doing this, man.
Yeah, man. Oh shit, man.
At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details. At Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.